Last night, I returned from a historic 12-day trip to Asia. This journey took us to five nations to meet with dozens of foreign leaders, participate in three formal state visits, and attend three key regional summits. It was the longest visit to the region by an American president in more than a quarter of a century. Everywhere we went, our foreign hosts greeted the American delegation, myself included, with incredible warmth, hospitality, and most importantly, respect. And this great respect showed very well our country is further evidence that America's renewed confidence and standing in the world has never been stronger than it is right now. When we are confident in ourselves, our strength, our flag, our history, our values, other nations are confident in us. And when we treat our citizens with the respect they deserve, other countries treat America with the respect that our country so richly deserves. During our travels, this is exactly what the world saw: a strong, proud, and confident America. Today, I want to update the American people on the tremendous success of this trip and the progress we've made to advance American security and prosperity throughout the year. When I came into office, our country was faced with a series of growing dangers. These threats included rogue regimes pursuing deadly weapons, foreign powers challenging America's influence, the spread of the murderous terror group ISIS, and years of unfair trade practices that had dangerously depleted our manufacturing base and wiped out millions and millions of middle-class jobs. The challenges were inherited, and these products really showed what previous mistakes were made over many years and even decades by other administrations. Some of these mistakes were born of indifference and neglect, others from naive thinking and misguided judgment. In some cases, the negative influence of partisan politics and special interests was to blame. But the one common thread behind all of these problems was a failure to protect and promote the interests of the American people and American workers. Upon my inauguration, I pledged that we would rebuild America, restore its economic strength, and defend its national security. With this goal in mind, I vowed that we would reaffirm old alliances and form new friendships in pursuit of shared goals. Above all, I swore that in every decision, with every action, I would put the best interests of the American people first. Over the past 10 months, traveling across the globe and meeting with world leaders, that is exactly what I have done. Earlier this year, in Saudi Arabia, I spoke to the leaders of more than 50 Arab and Muslim nations about our strategy to defeat terrorists by stripping them of financing, territory, and ideological support. And I urged the leaders to drive out the terrorists and extremists from their societies. Since that time, we have dealt ISIS one crushing defeat after another. In Israel, I reaffirmed the unbreakable bond between America and the Jewish state, and I met with leaders of the Palestinian Authority and initiated an effort to facilitate lasting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. In Brussels, I urged our NATO allies to do more to strengthen our crucial alliance and set the stage for significant increases in member contributions. Billions and billions of dollars are pouring in because of that initiative. NATO, believe me, is very happy with Donald Trump and what I did. In Warsaw, I declared to the world America's resolve to preserve and protect Western civilization and the values we hold so dear. In Rome, Sicily, Hamburg, and Paris, I strengthened our friendships with key allies to promote our shared interests of security and prosperity. In September, at the United Nations General Assembly in New York, I urge that the nations of the world join in confronting rogue regimes that threaten humanity and laid out a model for international cooperation grounded in respect for sovereignty and the responsibilities that come with it. On each trip, I have worked to advance American interests and leadership in the world. And to each of these places, I have carried our vision for a better, a vision for something stronger and sovereign, so important, sovereign and independent nations rooted in their histories, confident in their destinies, and cooperating together to advance their security, prosperity, and the noble cause of peace. It was this same vision that I carried to Asia 2 weeks ago, and it was this same commitment to you, the American people, that was always at the forefront of my mind and my thinking. Our trip was defined by three core goals. First, to unite the world against the nuclear menace posed by the North Korean regime, a threat that has increased steadily through many administrations and now requires urgent action. Second, to strengthen America's alliances and economic partnerships in a free and open Indo-Pacific, made up of thriving independent nations respectful of other countries and their own citizens, and safe from foreign domination and economic servitude. And third, to finally, after many years, insist on fair and reciprocal trade. Fair and reciprocal trade. So important. These two words, fairness and reciprocity, are an open invitation to every country that seeks to do business with the United States. And they are a firm warning to every country that cheats, breaks the rules, and engages in economic aggression, like they've been doing in the past, especially in the recent past. That is why we have almost an $800 billion a year trade deficit with other nations. Unacceptable. We are going to start whittling that down, and as fast as possible. With these goals, it was my profound honor to travel on this journey as your representative. I explained to all of the world leaders and across Asia how well the United States is doing. Economic growth has been over 3% the last two quarters and is going higher. Unemployment is at its lowest level in 17 years. The stock market has gained trillions of dollars in value since my election and has reached record highs. We are massively increasing our military budget to historic levels. The House has just passed a nearly $700 billion defense package, and it could not come at a better time for our nation. Once again, our country is optimistic about the future, confident in our values, and proud of our history and a role in the world. I want to thank every citizen of this country for the part you have played in making this great American comeback possible. In Asia, our message was clear and well received. America is here to compete, to do business, and to defend our values and our security. We began our trip in Hawaii to pay our respects to brave American service members at Pearl Harbor and the United States Pacific Command, the guardian of our security and freedom across the Indo-Pacific region. As our country prepared to observe Veterans Day, we remembered the incredible sacrifices and courage of all of the veterans whose service has preserved our liberty and a way of life that is very special. We also thanked military families for their support for our brave servicemen and women. From Hawaii, we traveled to Japan, a crucial U.S. ally and partner in the region. Upon landing in Japan, my first act was to thank the American service members and Japanese self-defense forces who personify the strength of our enduring alliance. Prime Minister Abe and I agreed on our absolute determination to remain united to achieve the goal of denuclearized North Korea. Shortly following our visit, Japan announced additional sanctions on 35 North Korean entities and individuals. Japan also committed to shouldering more of the burden of our common defense by reimbursing costs borne by American taxpayers, as well as by making deep investments in Japan's own military. This will include purchases of U.S. advanced capabilities, from jet fighters to missile defense, systems worth many, many billions of dollars, and jobs for the American worker. Prime Minister and I also discussed ways we can deepen our trade relationship based on the core principles of fairness and reciprocity. I am pleased that since January of this year, Japanese companies have announced investments in the United States worth more than $8 billion, 17,000 jobs. Japanese manufacturers Toyota and Mazda announced that they will be opening a new plant in the United States that will create 4,000 jobs. We also signed agreements between our nations to enhance infrastructure development, increase access to affordable energy, and advance our foreign policy goals through economic investment. From Japan, we traveled to another key American ally in Asia, the Republic of Korea. My official state visit to South Korea was the first by an American president in 25 years. Speaking before the National Assembly of the Republic of Korea, I spoke the truth about the evil crimes of the North Korean regime, and I made clear that we will not allow this twisted dictatorship to hold the world hostage to nuclear blackmail. I called on every nation, including China and Russia, to unite in isolating the North Korean regime, cutting off all ties of trade and commerce until it stops its dangerous provocation on, and this is the whole key to what we're doing, on denuclearization. We have to denuclearize North Korea. We have ended the failed strategy of strategic patience, and as a result, we have already seen important progress, including tough new sanctions from the UN Council. We have a Security Council that has been with us and just about with us from the beginning. South Korea agreed to harmonize sanctions and join the United States in sanctioning additional rogue actors whose funds have helped North Korea and North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. It's unacceptable to us. The United States welcomed the decision of President Moon to remove the payload restrictions on missiles to combat the North Korean threat. And together, we reaffirmed our commitment to a campaign of maximum pressure. Like Japan, South Korea is increasing its defense contributions. During our meetings, President Moon acknowledged his desire for equitable cost sharing for the United States military forces stationed in South Korea. And I visited soldiers at Camp Humphreys, a brand new joint American-South Korean base, paid for almost entirely by the South Korean government. At that base, I discussed with the United States and South Korean military leaders both military options and readiness to respond to North Korean provocation or offensive actions. During our visit, President Moon and I also discussed America's commitment to reducing our trade deficit with South Korea. At my discretion and direction, we are currently renegotiating the disastrous U.S.-Korea trade agreement signed under the previous administration. It has been a disaster for the United States. Last week, 42 South Korean companies announced their intent to invest in projects worth more than $17 billion in the United States, and 24 companies announced plans to purchase $58 billion in American goods and services. From South Korea, Melania and I traveled to China, where, as in Japan and South Korea, we were greatly honored by the splendor of our reception. Our trip included the first official dinner held for a foreign leader in the Forbidden City since the founding of the modern China, where we enjoyed a very productive evening hosted by President Xi and his wonderful wife, Madam Peng. During our visit, President Xi pledged to faithfully implement United Nations Security Council resolutions on North Korea and to use his great economic influence over the regime to achieve our common goal of a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. President Xi recognizes that a nuclear North Korea is a grave threat to China, and we agree that we would not accept a so-called freeze-for-freeze agreement, like those that have consistently failed in the past. We made that time is running out, and we made it clear, and all options remain on the table. I also had a very candid conversation with President Xi about the need to reduce our staggering trade deficit with China and for our trading relationship to be conducted on a truly fair and equitable basis. We can no longer tolerate unfair trading practices that steal American jobs, wealth, and intellectual property. The days of the United States being taken advantage of are over. In China, we also announced $250 billion worth in trade investment deals that will create jobs in the United States. From China, I flew to the city of Da Nang in Vietnam to attend the leaders' meeting for APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. There, I spoke to a major gathering of business leaders where I reminded the world of America's historic role in the Pacific as a force for freedom and for peace. Standing on this proud history, I offered our vision for robust trading relationships in which Indo-Pacific nations can all prosper and grow together. I announced that the United States is ready to make bilateral trade deals with any nation in the region that wants to be our partner in fair and reciprocal trade. We will never again turn a blind eye to trading abuses, to cheating, economic aggression, or anything else from countries that profess a belief in open trade but do not follow the rules or live by its principles themselves. No international trading organization can function if members are allowed to exploit the openness of others for unfair economic gain. Trade abuses harm the United States and its workers, but no more. No more. We will take every trade action necessary to achieve the fair and reciprocal treatment that the United States has offered to the rest of the world for decades. My message has resonated. The 21 APEC leaders, for the first time ever, recognize the importance of fair and reciprocal trade, recognize the need to address unfair trade practices, and acknowledge that the WTO is in strong need of reform. These leaders also noted that countries must do a better job following the rules to which they agree. I also made very clear that the United States will promote a free and open Indo-Pacific in which nations enjoy the independence and respect they deserve. In Vietnam, during a state visit in Hanoi, I also met with President Quan and Prime Minister Phuc to discuss the growing friendship between our countries. Our Vietnamese partners are taking new actions to enforce sanctions on North Korea. In addition, we committed to expand trade and investment between our countries, and we pledged to address the imbalances. I am particularly pleased that the United States and Vietnam recently announced $12 billion in commercial agreements, which will include $10 billion in U.S. content. Finally, I visited the Philippines, where I met with numerous world leaders at the U.S. ASEAN and East Asia summits. At ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, we made it clear that no one owns the ocean. Freedom of navigation and overflight are critical to the security and prosperity of all nations. I also met with the prime ministers of India, Australia, and Japan to discuss our shared commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific. During our visit, President Duterte of the Philippines thanked the American people and our armed forces for supporting the recent liberation of Marawi from ISIS. We pledge to strengthen and deepen our longstanding alliance. At the East Asia Summit, the United States negotiated and signed four important leader statements on the use of chemical weapons, money laundering, poverty alleviation, and countering terrorist propaganda and financing. And crucially, at both summits and throughout the trip, we asked all nations to support our campaign of maximum pressure for North Korean denuclearization. And they are responding by cutting trade with North Korea, restricting financial ties to the regime, and expelling North Korean diplomats and workers. Over the last 2 weeks, we have made historic strides in reasserting American leadership, restoring American security, and reawakening American confidence. Everywhere we went, I reaffirmed our vision for cooperation between proud, independent, and sovereign countries. And I made clear that the United States will be a reliable friend, a strong partner, and a powerful advocate for its own citizens. The momentum from our trip will launch us on our continued effort to accomplish the three core objectives I outlined: to unite the world against North Korean nuclear threat, to promote a free and open Indo-Pacific region, and to advance fair and reciprocal economic relations with our trading partners and allies in the region. We have established a new framework for trade that will ensure reciprocity through enforcement actions, reform of international organizations, and new fair trade deals that benefit the United States and our partners. And we have laid out a pathway toward peace and security in our world where sovereign nations can thrive, flourish, and prosper side by side. This is our beautiful vision for the future. This is a future where this vision, this dream, is only possible if America is strong, proud, and free. As long as we are true to ourselves, faithful to our founding, and loyal to our citizens, then there is no task too great, no dream too large, no goal beyond our reach. My fellow citizens, America is back, and the future has never looked brighter. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all.
Up next, this week's press conference with the spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, Maria Zakharova, from Moscow, Thursday.
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon. First, let me start with the schedule of the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, as it was stated previously. Quite soon, Sergei Lavrov is going to Azerbaijan and Armenia. I would like to talk about these visits more closely. On 20 November, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov, will be visiting официальным визитом в Азербайджанской республике. Предусмотрены переговоры с министром иностранных дел Азербайджана, в ходе которых предполагается провести обмен мнениями по широкому спектру вопросов двусторонней, международной и региональной повестки дня. Как мы неоднократно говорили, как демонстрируется на конкретных делах, Азербайджан наш важный стратегический партнер в нынешнем году. В этом году мы отмечаем 25-летие of the establishment of diplomatic relations between our countries. Our relations are based on long-established traditions of friendship and mutual respect, as well as convergence or similarity of positions on key issues of regional and international agenda. The political dialogue at the highest level sets the tone for the Azerbaijan-Russia cooperation. Regular contacts between the president of Russia and Azerbaijan determine the strong momentum of bilateral relations and help to address in an urgent manner any issues and coordinate actions in various regional and international platforms. We support intensive contacts at other levels, especially we maintain inter-parliamentary ties, we develop economic cooperation, and humanitarian and cultural ties are well developed, also being in close cooperation with other co-chairs of the OSCE Minsk Group. Russia continues to help parties to Nagorno-Karabakh conflict in their search of mutually acceptable solutions. On the 20th, 21st of November, the Minister Sergey Lavrov is going to visit Armenia. He's scheduled to hold talks with his Armenian counterpart and to hold a meeting with the President of Armenia. This visit is conducted in the year that marks the 25th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between two countries and the 20th anniversary of the Treaty on Friendship, Cooperation and Mutual Assistance. Ministers will take part in the opening exhibition Russia and Armenia. Friendship intensifies through centuries, and as well as they will take part in the ceremony of step consolation that marks this landmark event that's so important for the diplomatic relations of Russia and Armenia. They also plan to sign the consultation plan. The agenda includes a wide range of cooperation that our countries maintain, especially in OSCE, CIS, CSTO, the Council of Europe, the Organization of Black Sea Cooperation, other international forums. The ministers will discuss the regional security and the prospects for Nagorno-Karabakh settlement, also political dialogue. At the highest level helps to resolve all the issues. The President of Armenia held negotiations with the President of Russia, and they also held negotiations on the 15th of November. You've seen the information published by the media in Chertikov Gallery. They took part in the opening ceremony of Armenia Days that are organized in our country. About supplementary events that will involve the participation of Sergey Lavrov. We will inform you about them if we have any information about that. His schedule is quite intense, but the changing situation in the world implies sometimes certain changes, so once again we're going to provide all the necessary information to you. Now let's move to our agenda. Especially, we'll talk about the situation in the world and Russia's position to addressing issues of the international agenda. Now let's talk about the situation in Syria. We see that in Syria they eliminate the IS terrorists. Certain terrorists go to the east bank of the Euphrates River. In the border areas, terrorists could be eliminated by Syrian democratic forces that are supported by the US-led anti-IS coalition. Unfortunately, that's not the case. The mass media publish more and more often the information that American partners that cooperate with us in the fight against international terrorism, they protect IS fighters. And I cannot help myself but comment the material that was published by BBC on the 13th of November. It was they published a major report that IS terrorists were evacuated from Raqqa under supervision of the Western coalition. They published a video. I hope that this confirmed information. If not, we have to comment this after that. But in this video, we see the 8 kilometers long IS convoy that leaves Raqqa. At the same time, the Russian Ministry of Defense accused the U.S. coalition of protecting IS fighters after Abu Kamal was liberated. Also, the ministry not only refused to strike the convoy, they also hindered the work of the Russian armed forces in the region. Such attitude cannot be qualified as a fair game. It's true that IS fighters won't stay for long in Syria. However, it's not we who should pose the question, but this question should be also posed by journalists. Where these hundreds of fantasists will go who were saved by our American colleagues? That's not the only question that we have for our partners. I have some other questions. What's the impact of the US actions, not only for the Middle East countries, but also for Russia, Europe, and Central Asia? We hope that American colleagues will follow those agreements in the fight against terrorism that were laid down in the joint statements of presidents of Russia and the United States following the meeting on the margins of the APEC conference that was organized in Da Nang on the 11th of November. With the defeat of IS and establishment of de-escalation zone, Syria de facto is about to shift from the years of armed confrontation to reconciliation, restoration of unity and the social economic situation after massive destruction of the Syrian infrastructure. Earlier, Syrians needed the help to counteract international terrorism, but today they need our help to organize broad inter-Syrian dialogue and to start political process, and also to increase international humanitarian assistance, particularly humanitarian demining and in saving sites of cultural heritage. Russia takes all the necessary steps to provide political and humanitarian assistance. Moscow is confident that the Russian initiative to convene the Syrian National Dialogue Congress will help to provide the additional impetus to positive trends that are emerging in Syria. And this is another step toward a peaceful settlement of the crisis in Syria. And I would like also to make an emotional comment. It's true that I would like to say, using all this professional terms concerning the convert of terrorists by our American our colleagues, we would like to say it in simple words. We're talking about the fight against terrorism. We tell about the fact that terrorists were protected and were encouraged by the US-led international coalition. But now, I would like to say these words. I would like to address the words to ordinary people living in Europe. When next time, well, I hope that this won't happen, but we see that these trends become more and more often. If terrorist acts will be organized in European cities and our European partners start to change their avatars in social media to encourage and support their colleagues and friends and their compatriots, when they are going to use the colors of national flags on the sites of cultural heritage, then just pose the question, where those extremists and fighters headed when they were protected by the US colleagues? What are they doing now? Where are they at the moment? It's not the question for politicians, it's just the question for ordinary people. Just now, try to ask this question as those who left Abu Kemal, what are they going to do next? And maybe we shouldn't wait for another terrorist act. We need to express our condemnation to the present political ideologists who support IS fighters, who help terrorists. They do everything to serve their own political interests. They want to save these terrorist units in Syria. Just think about it. Actually, we were surprised. We have received many requests to comment the situation. Now I would like to comment this situation. We were surprised to hear the statement by the Jason Mattis that was made on the 30th of November that the armed forces, located in Syria with the authorization of the UN. We would like to understand, maybe this question shouldn't be left unanswered. Finally, we would like to receive an answer from our American colleagues. What exactly are you talking about? What mandate did you receive? Maybe you have a copy of a certain document. What was the Ministry of Defense talking about? He's a serious person. He makes serious decisions. And everything depends from his words, not only in the United States, but in the entire world. What was he talking about? I would like to remind you that the UN Security Council is the only UN body that can take decisions to use force by the international community. But this UN body didn't provide this mandate to our American colleagues. At the same time, American soldiers are deployed there, and they ignore the will of the Syrian government. Once again, we are surprised by this statement. We have posed the these questions about the presence of American soldiers in the Syrian territory. The State Secretary Rex Tillerson said that the only objective of the U.S. is to defeat ISIS there. But in our understanding, after the defeat of the terrorist hotbed, that once again, now it's being completed, but since certain terrorists were protected, after the defeat of the IS group, Americans should leave Syria. But at the same time, the minister said that American soldiers are not going to leave Syria before the progress will be attained on the settlement of the Syrian crisis. But another question that I have for our American colleagues, and who will answer the question if there is enough progress on the Syrian settlement? Do you have a mechanism or a scale so that to understand that it's enough to present in Syria? I think that the United States want to have this right. They want to control a certain part of the Syrian territory and to do that as much as they want. And their objective is want to achieve the result that they need, and they want to do that by force. And I would like to remind you that according to the UN Security Council Resolution 2254, that that the decision may be made by the Syrian people. We can all provide assistance to them. We can offer ideas, projects on the future government, the future of Syria. But this will be just supplementary actions to the dialogue that will be organized in Syria. That's the dialogue that was brokered by Iran, Turkey, and Russia. And now we see a steady trend to in this area. We worry about the will of the American colleagues to live in the house that does not belong to them. As Sergei Lavrov stated, that we hope that the United States will work on their position about their presence in Syria, and we would like to see that this position will be voiced on the international arena so that we could understand this position. Now, I would like to talk about the situation. I was asked to comment it. We have commented it many times, but I would like to tell you about the situation in Lebanon. We closely follow the situation in Lebanon. As you know, the president of the Lebanese Republic, Michel Aoun, after the consultations with the key political forces, he refused to recognize the televised address made by the Prime Minister Hariri that was transmitted on the 4th of November. There, Hariri asked the president to resign. The president stresses the need to carry out the formal procedures as it's provided by the Lebanese legislation and to file the resignation that should be personally written by Hariri. This will confirm free and non-imposed nature of this decision. In any case, the incumbent Prime Minister of Lebanon, Hariri, is in Saudi Arabia at the moment. He meets with foreign representative, especially with the Russian ambassador in Riyadh on the 12th of November. Hariri gave another interview. There he expressed his hope that he could return to Lebanon in several days. The Prime Minister did not exclude the possibility that he could debunk his statements made on the 4th of November, but also he set out certain conditions that concerning the mutual understanding between Lebanon political forces that formed the coalition government that he heads. At the same time, in Lebanon, we see the social cohesion that represent different political forces and religions. They express commitment to the sovereignty of their country. The Lebanon leadership maintain active contacts with key world capitals encourage the international community to support their sovereignty. On the 17th of November, the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Immigrants, Basile, will make a working visit to Russia. He will meet with Sergei Lavrov. Russia's position on the situation in Lebanon remains the same. We strongly support the sovereignty of Lebanon, the independence and territorial integrity of this friendly country. We also stand for the fact that it's up for Lebanons to work on their national agenda, and we stand against any external intervention that threats that can upset the established balance in politics and interfaith relations. We would like to take notice of the fact that Lebanon overcame the vacuum of executive power. They elected their president and formed a coalition government headed by Hariri. State agencies started working together. They will address major issues concerning the elimination of hotbeds of international terrorism on Lebanese-Syrian border. We hope that Lebanese will succeed in maintaining this positive trends, and they will prevent a new government and political crisis that will question the organization of general elections in May 2018, and we will support Russia.
another topic. We have received a large number of requests to comment on it, the situation in Zimbabwe. We see a serious aggravation of the internal political situation in the country. On the 15th of November, representative of the armed forces declared on the state television that the military offensive who have blocked the government buildings in Harare is targeted against the criminal elements in the power, whose actions result in the degradation of the economic situation in the country. They underline that the Mugabe family was guaranteed security and safety, and the population is called to keep calm. We welcome the declaration made by the President of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, made in the name of the South African Development Community on the 15th of November, expressing hope that internal political differences in Zimbabwe would be settled exclusively within the framework of the constitutional field in accordance with the principles of the South African Development Community and African Union. According to the Russian embassy in Harare, the situation in Zimbabwe remains calm. Nevertheless, we recommend to the Russian citizens to temporarily refrain from trips to Zimbabwe. We continue monitoring the situation. Another region where the situation is highly unstable is Afghanistan. We have taken note of the recent information published by Fergana agency called Who Helps ISIS Strengthen Its Positions in the North of Afghanistan. The article cites the statements of the representatives and authorities of a number of northern provinces of the country, Saripul, Balkh, Faryab and Kunduz, as well as parliamentarians of Afghanistan and locals. The article shows facts that prove the strengthening of positions of ISIS militants in the border zones in Central Asia. Such revelations demonstrate that, unfortunately, once again, ISIS wing of in Afghanistan gets support from the US and NATO forces, including help in transporting their terrorists in a so-called unidentified helicopters and providing weapons. We all know this model. We talked about it a couple of minutes ago when I was citing BBC report. This once again shows the matter of the true goals of military presence in Afghanistan. We call on the authorities of Afghanistan to investigate all of the facts mentioned in the article, as well as to take urgent measures to prevent the growth of terrorist threat in the bordering states in Central Asia. Another topic connected with the situation in Afghanistan. I would like to comment on the presentation of the yearly report of the UN Drug Agency, a report on Afghan opiates in 2017. We are concerned about the catastrophic degradation of the situation with illegal drug traffic in Afghanistan. According to the new report of the UN Drug and Crime Agency, on opiates in Afghanistan, the overall area of opiate growth in 2017 has grown more than by 60% and is currently 328 hectares. The opiate production has also grown since last year. The growth was almost twofold and is currently at 900 tons in heroin equivalent. This is the highest value in the last years. And there is hardly any positive dynamic in the destruction of opiate fields in northern Afghanistan. It cannot be compared to the scale of the growing drug trafficking. These figures demonstrate that the global community should reevaluate and, in some sense, it should correct its efforts in the fight against drug problems in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, we have to declare that the current policy of the Afghan law enforcement agencies does not, in fact, cover the Taliban-controlled provinces where opiates are being grown. The current ISIS cells in the north of the country are also trying to use the illegal drug traffic to strengthen their own material base. The opiate industry in Afghanistan has become a key source of feeding terrorist activities, which results in the further destabilization of the situation in the country and outside of it. The United Nations Security Council qualifies the Afghan drug industry as a threat to international peace and security. It is apparent that the growth in the opiate production in Afghanistan will have global implications and will result in further diversification of drug traffic routes and the search for new markets for opiates and the involvement in the criminal business of a growing number of people, which will finally result in the growth of drug addicts. In this situation, the Afghan authorities, with the support of the international donor community, will need to make additional efforts aimed at intensifying the fight against the illegal drug trade. It can only be done collectively by joint efforts based upon the relevant international documents. Only then will the Afghan authorities cut the drug flow. We think that the regional efforts to counteract the Afghan drug traffic should be promoted by using the resources of such respected international organizations as the Paris Pact, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Organization of the Treaty for Collective Security. We are ready to continue promoting constructive cooperation with Afghan authorities based on the principles of joint and common responsibility for the solution of the Afghan drug problem. We are going to keep helping Kabul in promoting and strengthening its anti-drug potential, including our efforts within the joint efforts with the projects for personnel training in the system of the Russian Internal Affairs Ministry. Moving on to other topics, I cannot but comment on this. Moreover, we had a question on this issue yesterday to the head of the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. Therefore, I would like to talk about it in detail. I would like to comment on the declaration of the Spanish authorities on the so-called Russian interference in the Catalan crisis. We have taken note of the recent declarations of the official representative of the Spanish government, Mendes de Vigo, the Minister of Defense of the country, Dolores de Cospedal, and the foreign minister of the country does this on the supposed interference of Russian hackers into the internal political processes in Spain, up to an attempt to change the constitutional order of the country in relation to the country in the autonomous community of Catalonia. We express our deep regret that the wave of anti-Russian propaganda that was started by the Western media, as this time caught Madrid, and Madrid has supported it on the official level in the context of the Catalan crisis. We are deeply concerned about the declarations of the foreign ministry that Russia is supposedly interested in weakening Spain. I would like our Spanish colleagues to start answering for their words, and we would like them to provide the facts. It is absolutely unclear what basis was used by the Spanish minister to make these revelations. Russia has on numerous occasions officially stated its strict position on the Catalan topic. Or perhaps Madrid did not hear that. We can just see the declaration of the Russian Foreign Ministry made on 11th of October and published on the official website of the ministry. Was the Spanish Foreign Ministry unaware of it? Perhaps they were not informed by the Spanish embassy in Moscow. I would also like to draw your attention to the fact that the report on the ministry website was translated into Spanish. Such neglect for objective factors and unjustified interest for accusations without any proof taken from doubtable.
Nothing
good about Spanish diplomacy, and this does nothing but damage the Russian-Spanish relations. And I would also like to draw your attention to the comments made by Sergei Lavrov yesterday during the press conference on this matter. I would also like to comment on the facts that shown in the number of online articles on the interpretation of the words of the Russian ambassador in Romania. We have seen this, and we would like to draw your attention to the comments of the Russian embassy in Romania. The comment is rather large, it takes several pages and you can read it, but we would just like to say that due to the statement of the Russian ambassador to Romania, Mr. Kuzmin, at the conference Development of Entrepreneurial Links with Russia that took place on the 9th of November, we draw your attention to the unacceptability of the online interpretation of the words on the future of Romanian-Moldovan relations that resulted in the incorrect translation into Romanian and partial quotations taken out of the wider context. I say once again that this information was debunked by our embassy in Romania. The text was published on the website of the embassy. We confirm that the Russian position on the support of sovereignty and territorial integrity of Moldova is unchanged, and it is stated in the agreement on friendship and cooperation between Russian Federation and the Republic of Moldova signed on the 19th of November 2001. I would also like to comment on the statement of Mr. Kull of the Federal Intelligence Service. When giving his speech in Munich, he characterized Russia not as a partner but rather as a threat to European security and condemned our country for the attempts to reclaim its leading role on the European continent and therefore, in his understanding, to weaken the European Union and weaken the relations between EU and the USA. It is regrettable that the authorities of the German intelligence agency cannot leave behind their ideological block thinking and they continue spreading these presumed anti-Russian phobias, and the elections to the Bundestag are long over, and the fears of interference were not confirmed, according to the statements of the German authorities. The fear of Russian hackers was not confirmed, as well as the Moscow attempts to destabilize Germany and discredit the German authorities. There are no facts about it. And at the same time, Berlin cannot calm down. Perhaps it is time to stop frightening in the society and the public of Germany and themselves by these fantasies of the Russian interference, which is non-existent in this context. Finally, there are the facts. It is not Russia that moves its forces to the German borders. These are the German troops that are once again on the territory of a former Soviet state. We are not the ones who surround Europe with a network of military bases and anti-missile defense complexes. It is not Russia that makes up new forms of informational pressure. So where does the threat come from and who is it addressed to? There is a threat of terrorism and extremism and the intensity of regional conflicts and crises, humanitarian, climate problems. We have to deal with real challenges that have to do with all of us, Russia, Germany, and all others. Perhaps instead of wasting our time to support confrontation rhetoric and holding back Russia, we would rather channel our energy to activate our relations and intensify our dialogue on topics of mutual interest. We would have supported movements in such a direction.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.